You're listening to Teatro Mundi Live. I'm Andrea Cetrullo, program curator at Teatro Mundi, and this is the second part of a conversation between philosopher and writer Federico Campagna and filmmaker and visual artist Chiara Ambrosio. Chiara tells us more about the intriguing Neapolitan cult of Santa Maria delle Anime del Purgatorio. Federico talks hospitality and finding therapeutical effects in non-human entities, such as books and talismans, and question where is the ineffable to be found in cities? What kind of architecture defies stark materialism and opens up to porousness and the unexpected? And what does the resurgence in an interest for magical practices tell us about the future of cities?
Poor, the derelict of Naples were not listened to by the official church. So they started developing a different kind of relationship to the other world through dream. So these souls would manifest themselves. You know, it takes, again, it's a syncretic form of religion. It brings in very different aspects from voodoo, from all kinds of things, in a very, very big gestural sort of collective and conscious thing, because it wasn't a literary sort of sort of construct. But they found these heads in the underground city, sort of, that was used as a place to play, as a shelter from the bombs, etc., etc. They found these unclaimed bones, which were initially the bones from the plague, and then that were just dumped in these huge subterranean caves that were the old Greek or Roman sewage system. And that runs the entire length of the city. And they sort of started developing a relationship with these souls. They were souls that were trapped in purgatory because they themselves were outsiders. They had nobody to pray for them. They had died in, you know, unsavory circumstances. They had not been claimed. They had not. So they developed a favorable relationship with these souls stuck in the other world, and they decided that they didn't need a priest or anyone to intercede for them. They could speak directly to these souls, and they could exchange favors. So they would pray for these souls, pay for masses for them, also bring them offerings like cigarettes, their favorite food, whatever. And in return, they would give them what they needed, winning lottery tickets. They would grant weddings for their daughters, etc. But I love it as a gesture of like subversion and exactly a liberation from those institutions that are there, is supposedly to help you become part of a community, but that in fact keep you chained into your condition as an other or outsider or a doomed sort of part of society. And it's a cult that continues today. And if you ask people in church, that's what I find very interesting. It was banned in the 80s. And then because of public clamor, it was reinstated as an underground cult. And if you ask people today, they still tell you, it's not real and it's illegal, but there are many, many people who are devoted to the cult. And so it remains as a form of religious anarchy in itself. I think it's a really interesting form an interesting example of how the imagination can actually often show a way out of your circumstance that you don't fully necessarily become aware of. If you speak to these people, they don't think they're doing anything subversive. They actually are not aware of the power of such a gesture. And I think there's real power in that when you are not doing something because you are part, as you say, of a new subculture, but because you're genuinely outside of any definition.
Yeah. No, thank you, Chiara, actually, for, yeah, I knew about this, but just in the back of my mind, and like you brought it back, and it's so interesting. I will look into it even more now. I just wanted to add that it's also interesting, also with the example of the Capuzelle, to keep in mind that the idea of community and the idea of solidarity do not coincide. They are different things. Solidarity is possible only outside of the realm of a community. Solidarity is possible with somebody, like friendship, in a particular way in which you encounter somebody else. It's a form of hospitality. Hospitality always includes an idea of difference and foreignness to each other, so that the foreigner, the stranger, are also potentially the enemy and so on, but also potentially the angel and so on and so forth. And solidarity derives from that particular way of encountering each other. When we encounter each other, we do not share the same flag, but somehow we decide to walk a part of the street of the way together, or to help each other because we see each other in each other, or for many whatever reason that we might have. So yeah, I just wanted to kind of underline how this aspect of solidarity is not excluded if one doesn't wish to be part of a community, but it is included in a different way.
This is what I find interesting. I've been running this podcast for over 2 years now, and what I do is that I encounter someone in the street often. I mean, before the pandemic, obviously, and we would not arrange we would not have a plan. We would not have an agenda. We would just meet. Often I met people I didn't know very well, that I only knew of. And we would give each other time, just two of us. So it's an encounter. It's not a group. It's just two people meeting. And I would ask them to choose a part of the city that meant something for them. And often they took me to places I didn't know. And we would walk. And it felt like our conversation became a form of almost recording, like the city became a recording device, and we were cutting a groove into this city just through our encounter, and through the encounter between our different perspectives on a similar space, this convergence into a space, and the power that this form of solidarity has is actually it was really surprising to me. I believe in, you know, I'm European, I believe in conversation, I believe in cafe culture, I believe in all of that, but this is something else. This is two people coming and moving through a space rather than coming to form a space of shelter. This is actually what happens if you take this form of solidarity and insert it almost like blood moving through the city, like forming a new set of networks, a different form of networks, thinking about the networking in a different way, creating these new nervous systems within the system that then become etched in the city and really become an alternative narrative, not the kind of alternative narratives that we're usually talking about when, you know, you try and apply for funding and they want to hear from minorities or this or that. I mean, what is truly an alternative narrative is also very interesting. And how can we create spaces? I mean, to me, the idea of incantation is interesting for this within a space, is how can you make another space possible and visible and conjure it in place with a witness, with the presence of other people and outside of other existing spaces. That's a real challenge because there is already so much that is constructed both in culture and outside of culture too. The so-called outsider position isn't an outsider anymore at all, actually.
Building on what Chiara was saying, it just came to mind another quality of these particular forms of encounters in which you you create something, and a friendship of sort. I prefer to say it in Italian because it contains the word the same root as amare, amicizia. Amicizia means friendship, and amitié in French. And it contains the element of love, amare, within it. So you create this particular relationship of solidarity with somebody else. So you create this experience of, is in solidus, something full. with somebody else. And this form of comradeship of sorts also has a particular quality to it, which is the quality of being therapeutic, which is something that I think is very important to cultural and artistic producers, such as the three of us discussing here tonight and many, many, many others. Why is it therapeutic? Literally, it is. Because in creating a relationship of solidarity with somebody else, despite and beyond and forgetting the particular specificities of each, as it happens in friendship, of course, you create a relationship of mutual help, or as the old anarchists would say, mutual aid. Now, in aiding each other, we assist each other. We are helpful comrades to each other. In Greek, this figure of the one that helps you, the assistant, is theraps. Theraps is the root of the word therapy. Therapy is that thing which helps you. Okay, so the relationship of therapy is a relationship of mutual aid. Now, this is possible physically, as Chiara was suggesting, but I would also add that in part in the production of culture, this is also something that is possible to do with artifacts. Many of my comrades, for example, you don't see it in the audio, but they are behind me. They are in my bookshelves. And many of my comrades have been dead for many, many hundreds of years. And they still help me therapeutically. They are my therapists. Sometimes in producing books in my case, or films in Chiara's case, and in many different forms, we still are providing not only cultural products, as they usually say in marketing courses, but we also are providing therapies to the people that read them.
You know, I have a photography project that's been running for 6 years, and a friend of mine who is it's called As Far As I Can Travel, and it's these very small books that I make that mostly fit within the hand, within the palm of your hand. And they're sent in the post to my subscribers. I have subscribers, and I send them a book every month. And they are a form of they're talismans. They are things that you carry with you. They mark a place, a time, an encounter, whatever. And a friend of mine, who's a professor of art and religion at Berkeley, is writing about them in her book about pilgrimage and art, and she sees them as these relics of pilgrimages done through the act of looking, you know, often pilgrimages that are done vicariously, and to me the book has a power in that sense. You know, I can see your comrades on your shelves behind you. It is not it is no different than encountering them physically, because the vessel of the book is such a powerful form of encounter as well. And I think that brings me back to the idea of space and how important it is to foster and nurture the spaces in which encounters are made, both, you know, physically at the same time, but also at different times, as in through a book, and therefore you need a library or a point of access to encounter them. And just to go back to what Andrea, you asked me earlier about the horse hospital, a place like the horse hospital intersects with many of our recent conversations, also in the sense that, unlike many other spaces I've encountered, I mean, perhaps it's the only one of its kind that does not, it's a hospital, it's an actual hospital. It used to be a horse hospital in the 17th century. So it is set up as a space of, I mean, mind you, at the time they were killing the horses, so it was a euphemism, really. But if we take the word that remains stuck with it, it is a place of therapy, but it is also a place that resists becoming a community. It's not a community space, and it's very clearly not a community. It is run by one person, and this is it's very London in that sense. It's one person who takes responsibility to keep this place free for many different people to come and be their singular selves within it. And that's why he kept it, Roger, who's run it for 25 years, has kept it free of funding. It does not receive funding from anyone. It is independently run with great difficulty, but it remains as a real access point to so many different stories that simply intersect there. They do not merge, they do not form, but there is great solidarity within it between all these narratives. And these spaces are what I call sacred spaces, if there are such things in a place, a space in which we can release hopes and prayers and hopes in the Berger way of thinking about hope into the, you know, as an act of commitment to the present, rather than as a whimsical thought about the future. So it's a garden in that sense. Gardens, orchards are what we need, you know, places where we have to actually dig. You know, each one has their own allotment, but we're all essentially looking after the same earth.
And also, if you say, and if you say garden in Persian, you would say paradisos.
Paradisos.
Paradise. That's what amazing. Paradise literally means. It is taken by the Greeks from the Persian, and it meant garden.
Federico, you talk about the rise, I'm going through my notes right now, of modular architecture kind of coinciding with technic. So I guess that's, you know, the notion of what Federico calls the ineffable, the singular encounter where we were talking about, you know, that singularity of things. So yeah, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how you see that crystallizing, or, you know, how we see them and how we see that in cities. Oh.
The ineffable is always present in a city. It's very, very easy to find it. It doesn't take much. You just have to look up the sky. I mean, this is always a good trick whenever you feel devastated by your situation. Always look up at the sky, simply because it reminds you of that. It is the original picture of the earth. No boundaries, no streets, no properties. So the ineffable is always present in a city. Of course, we don't usually look at it. And once again, often there is a class element to it. If you're poor and working 20 hours a day, good luck looking at the sky and remembering that. There is more and more you look down and you try to find the traces of the ineffable in the breakages. So for the poor, once again, we repackage for ourselves, our shit condition with some nice packaging, say that in the breakages, in the glitches, in the sewage, in the spillage, in the dead carcass of a pigeon on the road, we can find the ineffable. We find it in the carcass of the dead pigeon on the road because we are hyper-exploited and like animals, we look down. But I don't think that Gwyneth Paltrow or whoever in her position looks for the ineffable in the carcass of a mouse that dead behind the kitchen counter. Now, so I wouldn't, in contemporary cities, I don't particularly find anything conducive directly to the ineffable in any way, anywhere, especially not in new forms of architecture. New forms of architecture in particular, especially the ones that try to transmit that element of ineffability, transparency, and so on and so forth, absolutely not. They don't speak about that at all. I think, for example, about this enormous towers of glass. Our cities are made of these stupid towers of glass everywhere. And if there was one possible way in which the kind of like the architecture of slave societies like Rome and ancient Egypt could be made, the architecture even more classist and exploitative is the glass towers. If you think about it, places like that we encounter in contemporary cities, like these glass towers, they for somebody who is forced, because they have to live in the city and they're forced to go around and work and so on and so forth, when they look around, they see these buildings that are nothing. In old cities, you would look around and see the facade of a Baroque church. You would see the obelisk to Ramses II carved with the best possible abilities. You would see the triumphal arch and so on and so forth. In contemporary cities, you see these empty box, these transparent boxes. And why are they built like that without a facade? Because they are not places to look at for the people on the street. They are lookouts for the people on the inside. The glass towers are built not to be looked at from the outside, but to be looked from the inside. They are for those who are inside to look down and to see the varied zoo of humanity underneath. So in the contemporary city, I think the supposed symbol of transparency and ineffability and so on and so forth, the transparency of the glass, is in fact just a reminder that there is still a privileged position in which the privilege consists in the ability to look down into the world as if you were already in a position of separation. And the task, I think, for us is, on the one hand, to demand for facades again, to demand ornament again, and to demand monuments again, because the monuments are not for the ultra-rich who live in their villas. The monuments are for the people that live in the squares. And also to kind of challenge this horrendous architecture that is all about the fact that a certain part of the population are cattle and a certain part are shepherds.
And also you end up with, you know, again with Sukh, that we were talking about the porousness of a city. You end up with a city with no history. You have surfaces that will not weather, that will not take in time or weather. You know, I'm thinking as you're speaking that I've been taking I've been finding shelter on the riverbanks more and more. So I've become very attuned. I've checked the tide calendar every day. And whenever the tide is low and I can get there, I tend to go to the banks, these sort of ephemeral spaces that are no man's land, most of them. You know, you can still disappear within them. You become attuned to a completely different way of the city, you know, apart from the fact that you have an incredible, ineffable force, like you talk about when you talk about the Mediterranean Sea, for example, or, you know, in a city like Naples with the volcano, you know, the river is such a thing, but not just any river, a tidal river that shifts 10 meters in a quarter of a day. That's a huge amount of water to shift. And then you also, of course, have all the open air museum that appears, you know. And I've been mudlarking myself. I got a permit, and it's a very interesting activity, isn't it? No, but it's fascinating to me because it's, you meet all kinds of people on the banks, and in fact, it's full of very, very old London anarchists on there who still cling onto these spaces that are, they feel they can still connect to on a physical level because they recognize the brick, they recognize the moss, they recognize the color of it, and they see it as something that they can look at and engage with, not something slippery that, as you say, is a lookout from someone on the inside. So they feel they feel like they have an agency on it. And I feel like I have an agency on time. You know, in some way, I feel part of a conversation about time when I walk on these banks. And I think that it's a really powerful, you know, a city like, the reason why like is not an interesting word, but I feel a connection with a city like London still, is because somewhere within, you know, it's not a question of looking for justification for poverty or social injustice, but there are ways in which the city resists its own sort of its own development. There are ways in which it resists it. The material of the city, like wherever you turn, there's something that's been opened. You know, there's wounds that open in the city, and you see this kind of brick and soil, you know, that essentially is what half of the city still build of. You know, when they made the London Stock, they dug it out of Tottenham Court Road. The first lot of London Stock bricks were dug out of the clay and bones of Tottenham Court Road, you know. And so it's a very interesting conversation between what is being constantly erased and what keeps coming back, for example, through the river, for example, through these kind of ineffable ways in which the city itself speaks.
My last question was more about this kind of, I don't know if you've noticed it, but there's a sort of resurgence in the interest for kind of, you know, anything to do with magic. But in a sense, it's kind of a cherry picking of it, of some happy aspects of it, nice aspects, the ones that are probably easier in a sense. So it's kind of like, you know, witchcraft and tarot, or even this year's Venice Biennial, I think it's 2021, it has been postponed, but it's around the theme of magic. Also the Ashmolean Museum, that was a recent exhibition on witchcraft. So if you have noticed this, I was just wondering if this would tell us something about what you were saying in terms of therapy. Is it a call? Is it something to do with people, you know, kind of looking for that sort of therapy more and more? Would it be an indication, or is it just, you know, not so meaningful, probably simply a trend. Do you find anything interesting in that trend, or do you have anything to say?
Can I just say one thing that really worried me about the Ashmolean exhibition, for example, which I went to see? There was a really beautiful, have you seen it, Federico? Spellbound, it was called. Apart from the fact that I hated the title, which was just ridiculous, but there was a whole room about cachets, and cachets were these envelopes made up of everyday objects that people would hide inside the house, and they would offer protection. I mean, as a good Southern Italian, I have my own sort of caches of things lying around the house. But what really struck me is that something that was part of a quotidian relationship to your objects, what Federico was saying about artifacts, was presented as something so esoteric. When in fact it was commonplace, it was part of a very different way of engaging with our surroundings, and it's very much something that I think we need to be mindful of when we talk about magic or, oh my God, shamanism. Everybody's a shaman now. Everybody's a conduit to other worlds, and you know. And I think that contextualizing, these objects aren't just things that are bought and sold at art galleries because they're quaint and strange and other and different. They were actually just, this in the same way as you would have your titular gods at the door in a Roman house. You know, you would have these things hidden in a wall. They were part of your necessary framework in which you could operate as a human being. And so I'm very skeptical of the way in which magic is being fetishized personally, because I actually believe that it moves us away from understanding what it really is. You know, so looking at a pebble, looking at the river, you know, being able to find that connection with what surrounds you now is what we should be thinking about, not looking for the exotic aspect of something that we don't fully understand, but actually trying and find that opening within our lives, within what is around us. And I can only think of doing that through commitment to your spaces, commitment to your objects. You have to learn how to see and feel and hear things. Otherwise, magic does not, magic in the sense that Federico talked about, you know, it's an understanding of an other form of existence doesn't apply.
Looking at the contemporary situation with magic makes me think of other moments in time when this resurgence of magic seemed to appear. Magic returns cyclically. You had it at the beginning of the 20th century. You had it during the time of the Renaissance in Italy. You had it in late antiquity. And in all these three cases, usually you have them before that particular world in which, that particular territory in which this resurgence takes place is about to implode. So just before the Belle Epoque was about to collapse with the First World War, there was a big interest in magic. Italian Renaissance is not usually thought about when you think about the Renaissance, the age of splendor and so on and so forth, is the age when Italy was devastated absolutely from the armies of the bigger powers around. Italy was fragmented in tiny, tiny, tiny places. And late antiquity is the same, when the Roman Empire was imploding, more than exploding, literally imploding, and there was this big resurgence of an interest in magic. Similarly today, I think this widespread interest in magic, I think, indicates that there is a possibility that we find ourselves in a similar mental landscape in which there is a premonition of a catastrophe of a certain frame of sense and a desire preemptively somehow to learn to acquaint ourselves with different ways of making world and with a certain distance with the only particular specific understanding of reality that we have in this society. So in that sense, I don't have too many problems with the various popularizations. If you think about the the way in which magic appeared, for example, in late antiquity, you had the most supreme examples, Proclus, Iamblichus, or the great Neoplatonists, but also the many prophets that were going around at the time, from Mani to Jesus Christ and so on and so forth. And then you had a multitude of thousands and thousands of magicians and tricksters and so on and so forth that were populating that Mediterranean world of the time. So I find it quite normal to a certain extent. The thing that I would encourage contemporary practitioners of magic is to maintain a certain faithfulness or commitment, as Chiara says, to the direction where magic can lead. Magic can lead to alternative imaginations of the present, which are contiguous and continuous with the present. Example, Harry Potter. Harry Potter is a film in which magic basically means fantastic technological breakthroughs that happen with an invisible technology. Okay, so that's basically what it is, the magic of Harry Potter. There are things that machines could do somehow, teleporting, moving around. But the direction of magic, I believe, it leads somewhere else. And in late antiquity, this was particularly clear. And it leads towards what I was mentioning earlier, mysticism. Magic doesn't present worlds that are continuous, alternative versions of the same, but presents you with a closeness with the absolute alterity, with that thing, with that moment within objects, within things, within reality, where all names and definitions disintegrate, and that place from which is possible to restart, re-enter the world, and reinvent new languages. You can only see things that are just a little bit away from your eye. You always need a certain distance to re-enter the world and play and change it. Push towards the edge of mysticism, magic, I think, can have an emancipatory potential that definitely is not present if it only remains, certainly it's not present if it only remains a series of objects sold and bought on the market. But that is an inevitable feature of this society, not only of this one. But also only if it's not contained in this imagination of magic as a form of technology. And one last thing about what Chiara was saying about the sashes, I completely share your, disgust sometimes at certain forms of musealization. I find it often when I see the handling of dead bodies in museums. I love the British Museum, despite the fact that it's mostly stuff that was looted, most of which from Italy, by the way. The National Gallery is no better. But the problem that I find at the British Museum is also, or in many museums, is often how bodies themselves are presented as if they were artifacts, or the way in which archaeology sometimes profanates tombs, as if they somehow, the fact that we no longer believe the things that these people believed, that you need a certain particular arrangement of your tomb in order to travel to the afterlife and to pass Anubis and so on and so forth, means that they were invalid. And so we can destroy their particular magical construction. That I find, I have to say, very problematic and quite disgusting sometimes.
Can I ask you something, going back to what you were saying? You made me think of the fact, for example, of how alchemy led to the development of pharmacology. For example, in Naples, the Farmacia degli Incurabili, there are all these records of how literally alchemical research literally opened the door to pharmacology. And then I was thinking of my great-grandfather, who, like many, at the beginning of the 20th century, was a medium and a neurologist. So I come from a family, you know, my mom's side of the family, they're all doctors, but my great-great-grandfather was a pharmacologist in Naples, and my great-grandfather was a neurologist and a medium, and he was publishing papers in this newspaper called Luce ed Ombra, based in Milan. And many of his papers actually said exactly what you said, which is that he saw spiritualism as a form of technological breakthrough. So he was drawing parallels between the development, say, of neurosis and the encounter with what he called actually the ineffable, but the spiritual world. So something, you know, he was writing about case studies of young children seeing the ghost of the dead grandmother and then developing neurosis, whatever. Anyway, but he was positing this idea that what we don't understand fully was in itself a form of technological breakthrough, because it would offer us new avenues in which to broaden our understanding of the world. But that was very much anchored in practice. So in a way, what I was trying to say about magic is that it seems to me to be completely separated from practice today. It's very much, as many things in our world, it relies on people who are spectators and very, very few who are active sort of practitioners. And I wonder whether you think that perhaps our condition right now is that we're suffering from is that we are less committed to practicing in whatever way our practice takes shape, and whether perhaps there is a need to return to process, or to make process a much more significant part of our life.
This is complicated, isn't it? Because then there is also, there's a problem sometimes when certain practices are abandoned to a certain extent. It's also because the people no longer see the point in engaging with them. They don't think that certain practices will lead them to something. And sometimes they don't think that because they don't believe the practice actually leads you to that place. And sometimes they don't believe it because they don't believe that that place exists, the place to which the practice is supposed to take you. And so I think in part to revive certain practices, there has to be also a kind of feedback loop with education. Education in part has to do with the discussion over the ontological existence of that place to which the practice can lead you. The moment you take seriously the notion that that place exists, then the practice makes sense and then you will engage with it. The moment you no longer believe that that place exists, or you don't think it exists, or you don't know it exists, then engaging with the practice becomes a hobby, which is probably worse than not engaging with the practice at all. So I think it is interesting sometimes to think of this dual relationship between practice and education. And going back to what I was mentioning earlier about books or cultural artifacts, they do have sometimes this educational value, as in the value of presenting, making the case purely and almost abstractly about the existence of places to which certain practices, which are necessarily specific, individual, solitary, and so on and so forth, can possibly take you.
Thank you both for your grace and generosity. It was actually very generous.
Thank you, Andrea. Nice to meet you. Ciao.
Ciao, goodbye.